Thank you for coming. Thank you for being here. My name is Neil Donald Walsh. The following audio program contains selections from Conversations with God and Uncommon Dialogue, Book 2, concerning our short-term solution, Building the New Society, and our long-term solution, Creating Global Loving Consciousness. It is a message from God, and in it, God suggests a social, sexual, educational, political, economic, and theological revolution on this planet, the likes of which we have never seen and seldom imagined. That suggestion is made within the context of our own stated desires as the planet's inhabitants. We have said that we choose to create a better life for all, to elevate our consciousness, to seek a newer world. God will not condemn us no matter what we choose. But if we choose this, He is willing to show us the way. He will not force us, however, to take her suggestions, not now, not ever. I find her words at once captivating, disturbing, challenging, uplifting. They're captivating in that they catch my breath with the scope and sweep of their reach. They are disturbing in that they show me to myself and the human race to me in a way which is very unsettling. They are challenging in that they put the dare to me as no one and nothing else ever has before. The dare to be better. The dare to be bigger than I have been. The dare to be the source of a world in which anger, petty jealousy, sexual dysfunction, economic inequity, educational tomfoolery, social inequality, and political secrecy, chicaneries, and power plays are never again part of the human experience. And they are uplifting in that they hold out the hope that all of this is possible. Can we really build such a world? God says yes, and that all it takes is for us to really choose to do it. My first experience of talking to God on your behalf occurred in 1992 and 93. I had written an angry letter to God asking why my life had become such a monument to struggle and failure in everything from my romantic relationships to my life work to my interactions with my children to my health. In everything, I was experiencing nothing but struggle and failure. My letter to God demanded to know why and what it took to make life work. To my astonishment, that letter was answered. How it was answered, and what those answers were, became a book published in May of 1995 under the title Conversations with God, Book 1. Perhaps you've heard of it, or maybe even read it. The selections you're about to hear are from an actual dialogue with God. Conversations with God, Book 2, is the second in a series of three books capturing a conversation with deity, which has lasted well over 5 years now and continues to this very day. You may not believe that this material has actually come from God, and I have no need for you to. What is important to me is only whether the material itself has any value, brings any insight, produces any awakening, sparks any renewed desire, or promotes any fruitful change in our day-to-day life on earth. God knows something has to change. We can't keep on going on as we have been. What you have here is that for which you have been looking, that for which you have been yearning for a very long time. What you have here is your latest, and for some of you perhaps your first, very real contact with God. This is a contact, and it is very real. God is going to have an actual conversation with you now, through me. I wouldn't have said this a few years ago. I'm saying it now because I've already had such a dialogue, and I therefore know that such a thing is possible. Not only is it possible, it's happening all the time, just as this is happening, right here, right now. What is important for you to understand is that you, in part, have caused this to happen, just as you have caused this audio program to be in your hands at this moment. We are all at cause in creating the events of our lives. And we are all co-creators with the one great creator in producing each of the circumstances leading up to those events. The process by which this information arrived was exquisitely simple. On a blank sheet of paper, I would merely write a question, any question, usually the first question that came to my head. And no sooner was the question written than the answer would form in my head, as if someone were whispering in my ear. I was taking dictation. With the exception of these few words I'm now speaking, all the material in this book was placed on paper between spring of 1993 and a little over 1 year later. I'd like to present it to you now, just as it came from me and was given to me. Our initial dialogue, God's and mine, was concluded just a month ago. I assume this one will go just like the first. That is, I ask questions and God answers. I guess I'll stop now and just ask God, how can I begin to be a part of the new consciousness?
Be a light unto the world, and hurt it not. Seek to build, not to destroy. Bring my people home.
How?
By your shining example. Seek only godliness. Speak only in truthfulness.
Act only in love. Live the law of love now and forevermore. Give everything. Require nothing.
Avoid the mundane.
Do not accept the unacceptable.
Teach all who seek to learn of me.
Make every moment of your life an outpouring of love.
Use every moment to think the highest thought, say the highest word, do the highest deed. In this, glorify your holy self, and thus too glorify me.
Bring peace to the earth by bringing peace to all those whose lives you touch. Be peace.
Feel and express in every moment your divine connection with the all and with every person, place, and thing.
Embrace every circumstance, own every fault, share every joy, contemplate every mystery, walk in every man's shoes, forgive every offense, including your own, heal every heart, honor every person's truth, adore every person's God, protect every person's rights, preserve every person's dignity, promote every person's interests, provide every person's needs, presume every person's holiness, present every person's greatest gifts, produce every person's blessing, and pronounce every person's future secure in the assured love of God.
Be a living, breathing example of the highest truth that resides within you. Speak humbly of yourself, lest someone mistake your highest truth for a boast.
Speak softly, lest someone think you are merely calling for attention.
Speak gently, that all might know of love.
Speak openly, lest anyone think you have something to hide.
Speak candidly, so you cannot be mistaken.
Speak often, so that your word may truly go forth.
Speak respectfully, that no one be dishonored. Speak lovingly, that every syllable may heal.
Speak of me with every utterance. Make of your life a gift. Remember always, you are the gift. Be a gift to everyone who enters your life, and to everyone whose life you enter. Be careful not to enter another's life if you cannot be a gift.
You can always be a gift because you always are the gift. Yet sometimes you don't let yourself know that. When someone enters your life unexpectedly, look for the gift that person has come to receive from you.
What an extraordinary way of putting it.
Why else do you think a person has come to you? I tell you this, every person who has ever come to you has come to receive a gift from you. In so doing, he gives a gift to you, the gift of your experiencing and fulfilling who you are. When you see this simple truth, when you understand it, you see the greatest truth of all. I have sent you nothing but angels.
I'm confused. Can we go back just a bit? There seems to be some contradictory data. I felt you were saying that sometimes the best help we can give people is to leave them alone. Then I felt you were saying, never fail to help someone if you see that person needs help. These two statements seem to be at odds.
Let me clarify your thinking on this. Never offer the kind of help that disempowers. Never insist on offering the help you think is needed. Let the person or people in need know all that you have to give. Then listen to what they want. See what they are ready to receive. Offer the help that is wanted. Often the person or people will say, or exhibit by their behavior, that they just want to be left alone. Despite what you think you'd like to give, leaving them alone might be the highest gift you can then offer. If at a later time something else is wanted or desired, you will be caused to notice if it is yours to give. If it is, then give it. Yet strive to give nothing which disempowers. That which disempowers is that which promotes or produces dependency. In truth, there is always some way you can help others which also empowers them. Completely ignoring the plight of another who is truly seeking your help is not the answer. For doing too little no more empowers the other than doing too much. To be of higher consciousness, you may not deliberately ignore the genuine plight of brothers or sisters, claiming that to let them stew in their own juice is the highest gift you can give them. That attitude is righteousness, an arrogance at the highest level. It merely allows you to justify your non-involvement. I refer you again to the life of Jesus and to his teachings. For it was Jesus who told you that I would say to those on my right, "Come, you blessed of my children, inherit the kingdom which I have had prepared for you. For I was hungry, and you gave me to eat. I was thirsty, and you gave me to drink. I was homeless, and you found me shelter. I was naked, and you clothed me. I was ill, and you visited me. I was in prison, and you brought me comfort." And they will say to me, "Lord, when did we see you hungry and feed you, or thirsty and give you drink? And when did we see you homeless and find you shelter, or naked and clothe you? And when did we see you ill or in prison and comfort you?" And I will answer them, replying, "Verily, verily, I say unto you, inasmuch as you have done it to the least of these, my brethren, so have you done it to me." This is my truth, and it still stands for all the ages.
I love you, you know that.
I know you do. And I love you.
Since we are discussing larger aspects of life on a planetary scale, as well as reviewing some of the elements of our individual lives, I would like to ask you about the environment.
What do you want to know?
Is it really being destroyed, as some environmentalists claim? Or are these people simply wild-eyed radicals, El Pinko liberal commies, all of whom graduated from Berkeley and smoked dope?
Yes to both questions. Not just kidding. Okay, yes to the first question and no to the second.
The ozone layer is depleted? The rainforests are being decimated?
Yes, but it's not just about such obvious things. There are matters less obvious about which you should be concerned.
Help me out here.
Well, for instance, there is rapidly developing a soil shortage on your planet. That is, you are running out of good soil in which to grow your food. This is because soil needs time to reconstitute itself, and your corporate farmers have no time. They want land that is producing, producing, producing. So the age-old practice of alternating growing fields from season to season is being abandoned or shortened. To make up for the loss of time, chemicals are being dumped into the land in order to render it fertile faster. Yet in this, as with all things, you cannot develop an artificial substitute for Mother Nature which comes even close to providing what she provides. The result is that you are eroding, down to a few inches really, in some places, the available nutritive topsoil reserve. In other words, you are growing more and more food in soil which has less and less nutritional content. No irons, no minerals. Nothing which you count on the soil to provide. Worse yet, you are eating foods filled with chemicals which have been poured into the soil in a desperate attempt to reconstitute it. While causing no apparent damage to the body in the short term, you will discover to your sadness that in the long run, these trace chemicals which remain in the body are not health-producing. This problem of soil erosion through rapid growing field turnover is not something of which most of your people may be aware. Nor is the dwindling growable soil reserve a fantasy made up by yuppie environmentalists looking for their next fashionable cause. Ask any earth scientist about it and you will hear plenty. It is a problem of epidemic proportions. It is worldwide and it is serious. This is just one example of the many ways you are damaging and depleting your mother, the earth, the giver of all life, out of a complete disregard for her needs and natural processes. You are concerned about little on your planet except the satisfying of your own passions, the meeting of your own immediate and mostly bloated needs, and quenching the endless human desire for bigger, better, more. Yet you might do well as a species to ask, when is enough enough?
Why do we not listen to our environmentalists? Why do we not heed their warnings?
In this, as in all really important matters affecting the quality and style of life on your planet, there is a pattern which is easily discernible. You have coined a phrase in your world which answers the question perfectly. Follow the money trail.
Oh, man, how can we ever hope to solve these problems when fighting something as massive and insidious as that?
Simple. Eliminate money.
Eliminate money?
Yes. Or at the very least, eliminate its invisibility.
I don't understand.
Most people hide the things they are ashamed of or don't want other people to know about. That is why the largest number of you hide your sexuality. And that is why nearly all of you hide your money. That is to say, you are not open about it. You consider your money to be a very private matter. And therein lies the problem. If everyone knew everything about everybody's money situation, there would be an uprising in your country and on your planet, the likes of which you've never seen. And in the aftermath of that, there would be fairness and equity, honesty and true for the good of all priority in the conduct of human affairs. It's now not possible to bring fairness or equity, honesty, or the common good to the marketplace because money is so easy to hide. You can actually physically take it and hide it. There are also all manner of means by which creative accountants can cause corporate money to be hidden or to disappear. Since money can be hidden, there's no way for anyone to know exactly how much anyone else has or what they are doing with it. This makes it possible for a plethora of inequity, if not to say double dealing, to exist. Corporations can pay two people vastly different wages for doing the same job, for instance. They can pay one person $57,000 a year while paying the other $42,000 a year for performing the exactly identical function, giving one employee more than the other simply because the first employee has something the second employee does not.
What's that?
A penis.
Oh.
Yes. Oh, indeed.
But you don't understand. Having a penis makes the first employee more valuable than the second. Quicker witted, smarter by half, obviously more capable.
I don't remember constructing you that way. I mean, so unequal in abilities.
Well, you did, and I'm surprised you don't know it. Everyone on this planet knows it.
We better stop this now, or people will think we're really serious.
You mean we're not? Well, we are. I mean, the people on the planet are. That's why women can't be Roman Catholic or Mormon priests, or show up on the wrong side of the Wailing Wall in Jerusalem, or climb to the top job in Fortune 500 companies, or pilot airliners.
Yes, we get the point. And my point is that pay discrimination, at least, would be much more difficult to get away with if all money transactions were made visible instead of hidden.
Mm.
Can you imagine what would happen in every workplace on the globe if all companies were forced to publish all the salaries of all the employees? Not the salary ranges for particular job classifications, but the actual compensation awarded to each individual.
Well, there goes playing two ends against the middle right out the window.
Yep.
And there goes what he doesn't know won't hurt him.
Yep.
And there goes, hey, if we can't get it for one-third less, why should we pay more?
Uh-huh.
And there goes apple polishing and kissing up to the boss and the inside track and company politics.
And much, much more would disappear from the workplace and from the world through the simple expedient of uncovering the money trail. Think of it. If you knew exactly how much money each of you holds and the real earnings of all your industries and corporations and each of their executives, as well as how each person and corporation is using the money it has, don't you think that would change things? Think about this. In what ways do you think things would change? The plain fact is that people would never put up with 90% of what is going on in the world if they knew what was going on. Society would never sanction the extraordinarily disproportionate distribution of wealth, much less the means by which it is gained, or the manner in which it is used to gain more, were these facts known, specifically and immediately, by all people everywhere. Nothing breeds appropriate behavior faster than exposure to the light of public scrutiny. That is why your so-called sunshine laws have done so much good in clearing away some of the awful mess of your political and governance system. Public hearings and public accountability has gone far toward eliminating the kinds of backroom antics that went on in the 20s, 30s, 40s, and 50s in your town halls and school boards and political precincts and national government as well. Now it's time to bring some sunshine to the way you deal with compensation for goods and services on your planet.
What are you suggesting?
This is not a suggestion. It is a dare. I dare you to throw out all your money, all your papers and coins and individual national currencies and start over. Develop an international monetary system that is wide open, totally visible, immediately traceable, completely accountable. Establish a worldwide compensation system by which people would be given credits for services rendered and products produced, and debits for services used and products consumed. Everything would be on the system of credits and debits. Returns on investments, inheritances, winnings of wages, salaries and wages, tips and gratuities, everything. Nothing could be purchased without credits. There would be no other negotiable currency, and everyone's records would be open to everyone else. It has been said, show me a man's bank account and I'll show you the man. This system comes close to that scenario. People would, or at least could, know a great deal more about you than they know now. But not only would you know more about each other, you would know more about everything. More about what corporations are paying and spending, and what their cost is on an item, as well as their price. Can you imagine what corporations would do if they had to put two figures on every price tag? The price and their cost? Would that bring prices down, or what? Would that increase competition and boost fair trade? You can't even imagine the consequences of such a thing. Under the new worldwide compensation system, WCS, the transfer of debits and credits would be immediate and totally visible. That is, anybody and everybody could inspect the account of any person or organization at any time. Nothing would be kept secret. Nothing would be private. The WCS would deduct 10% of all earnings each year from the incomes of those voluntarily requesting such a deduction. There would be no income tax, no forms to file, no deductions to figure, no escape hatch to construct or obfuscation to manufacture. Since all records would be open, everyone in the society would be able to observe who was choosing to offer the 10% for the general good of all and who was not. This voluntary deduction would go towards support of all the programs and services of the government as voted on by the people. The whole system would be all very simple, all very visible.
And the world would never agree to such a thing.
Of course not. And do you know why? Because such a system would make it impossible for anyone to do anything they didn't want someone else to know about. Yet why would you want to do something like that anyway? I'll tell you why. Because currently you live within an interactive social system based on taking advantage, getting the edge, making the most, and the survival of the so-called fittest. And the chief aim and goal of your society, as it is in all truly enlightened societies, is the survival of all, the benefit equally of all, the providing of a good life for all. Then your need for secrecy and quiet dealings and under-the-table maneuverings and money which can be hidden will disappear. You realize how much good old-fashioned corruption, to say nothing of lesser unfairnesses and inequities, would be eliminated through the implementation of such a system. The secret here, the watchword here, is visibility.
Wow, what a concept, what an idea. Absolute visibility in the conduct of our monetary affairs. I keep trying to find a reason why that would be wrong, why that would not be okay, but I can't find one.
Of course you can't, because you've got nothing to hide. But can you imagine what the people of money and power in the world would do and how they would scream if they thought of every move, every purchase, every sale, every dealing, every corporate action and pricing choice and wage negotiation, every decision whatsoever could be reviewed by anyone simply looking at the bottom line. I tell you, there's nothing breeds fairness faster than visibility. Visibility is simply another word for truth. Know the truth, and the truth shall set you free. Governments, corporations, people of power know that, which is why they will never allow the truth, the plain and simple truth, to be the basis of any political, social, or economic system they would devise. In enlightened societies, there are no secrets. Everyone knows what everyone else has, what everyone else earns, what everyone else pays in wages and taxes and benefits, what every other corporation charges and buys and sells, and for how much and for what profit, and everything. Everything. You know why this is possible? Only in enlightened societies. Because no one in enlightened societies is willing to get anything or have anything at someone else's expense.
That is a radical way to live.
It seems radical in primitive societies, yes. In enlightened societies, it seems obviously appropriate.
I'm intrigued by this concept of visibility. Could it extend beyond monetary affairs? Might it be a watchword for our personal relationships as well?
One would hope so.
And yet it isn't.
As a rule, no, not yet on your planet. Most people still have too much to hide.
Why? What's that about?
In personal relationships, and in all relationships, really, it's about loss. It's about being afraid of what one might lose or fail to gain. At the best personal relationships, and certainly the best romantic ones, are relationships in which everyone knows everything, in which visibility is not only the watchword, but the only word, in which there simply are no secrets. In these relationships, nothing is withheld, nothing is shaded or colored or hidden or disguised. Nothing is left out or unspoken. There is no guesswork. There is no game playing. No one is doing a dance, running a number, or shining you on.
Yeah, but if everyone knew everything we were thinking...
Hold it. This isn't about having no mental privacy. No safe space in which to move through your personal process. That's not what I'm talking about here. This is about simply being open and honest in your dealings with another. This is about simply telling the truth when you speak and about withholding no truth when you know it should be spoken. This is about never again lying or shading or verbally or mentally manipulating or twisting your truth into the 101 other contortions which typify the largest number of human communications. This is about coming clean, telling it like it is, giving it to them straight. This is about ensuring that all individuals have all the data and know everything they need to know on a subject. This is about fairness and openness and, well, visibility. Yet this does not mean that every single thought, every private fear, every darkest memory, every fleeting judgment, opinion, or reaction must be placed on the table for discussion and examination. That is not visibility. That is insanity. It will make you crazy. We are talking here about simple, direct, straightforward, open, honest, complete communication. Yet even at that, it is a striking concept and a little used.
You can say that again.
Yet even at that, it is a striking concept.
A little used one, yeah. He should have been in vaudeville.
Are you kidding? I am.
Well, seriously, this is a magnificent idea. I mean, imagine an entire society built around the principle of visibility. Are you sure it would work?
I'll tell you something. Half the world's ills would go away tomorrow. Half the world's worries, half the world's conflicts, half the world's anger, half the world's frustration. Oh, there would be anger and frustration at first, make no mistake about that, when it was finally discovered just how much the average person is being played like a fiddle, used like a disposable commodity, manipulated, lied to, and downright cheated. There would be plenty of frustration and anger. But visibility would clean most of that up within 60 days. Make it go away. Let me invite you again. Just think about it. You think you could live a life like this? No more secrets? Absolute visibility? If not, why not? What are you keeping from others that you don't want them to know? What are you saying to someone that isn't true? What are you not saying to someone that is? Has lying by omission or commission brought your world where you really want it to be? Has manipulation of the marketplace, of a particular situation, or simply of a person whose silence and secrecy really benefited us? Is privacy really what makes our governmental, corporate, and individual lives work? What would happen if everybody could see everything? Now, there is an irony here. Don't you see that this is the one thing you fear about your first meeting with God? Don't you get that what you've been afraid of is that the gig is up, the game is over, the tap dance is finished, the shadow boxing is done? And the long, long trail of deceits, big and small, has come to, quite literally, a dead end. Yet the good news is that there is no reason for fear, no cause to be scared. No one is going to judge you. No one is going to make you wrong. No one is going to throw you into the everlasting fires of hell. But to you Roman Catholics, no, you won't even go to purgatory. And to you Mormons, no, you won't be trapped forever in the lowest heaven, unable to get to the highest heaven, nor will you be labeled sons of perdition and banished forever to realms unknown. And to you, well, you get the picture. Each of you has constructed within the framework of your own particular theology some idea, some concept of God's worst punishment. I hate to tell you this, because I see the fun you're having with the drama of it all, but, well, just ain't no such thing. Perhaps when you lose the fear of having your life become totally visible at the moment of your death, you can get over the fear of having your life become totally visible while you are living it.
Boy, wouldn't that be something?
Yeah, wouldn't it, though? So here's the formula to help you get started. Go back to the first volume of this audio program and review again the 5 levels of truth-telling. Determine to memorize this model and implement it. Seek the truth, say the truth, live the truth every day. Do this with yourself and with every person whose life you touch. Then get ready to be naked. Stand by for visibility.
Ooh, this feels scary. This feels real scary.
Look to see what you're afraid of.
I'm afraid everyone will leave the room. I'm afraid no one will like me anymore.
I see. You feel you have to lie to get people to like you?
Not lie, exactly. Just not tell them everything.
Remember what I said before. This is not about blurting out every little feeling, thought, idea, fear, memory, confession, or whatever. This is simply about always speaking the truth, showing yourself completely. With your dearest loved one, you can be physically naked, can you not?
Yes.
Then why not be emotionally naked as well?
Well, the second is much harder than the first.
I understand that. That doesn't fail to recommend it, however, for the rewards are great.
Well, you certainly brought up some interesting ideas. Abolish hidden agendas, build a society on visibility, tell the truth all the time to everyone about everything. Whew.
On these few concepts, entire societies have been constructed. Enlightened societies.
I haven't found any.
I wasn't speaking of your planet.
Oh.
Or even your solar system.
Oh.
But you don't have to leave the planet or even leave your house to begin experiencing what such a new thought system would be like. Start in your own family, in your own home. If you own a business, start in your own company. Tell everyone in your firm exactly what you make, what the company is making and spending, and what each and every employee makes. They'll shock the hell out of them. I mean that quite literally. It will shock the hell right out of them. If everyone who owned a company did this, work would no longer be a living hell for so many because a greater sense of equity, fair play, and appropriate compensation would automatically come to the workplace. Tell your customers exactly what a product or service costs you to provide. Put those two numbers on your price tag, your cost and your price. Can you still be proud of what you're asking? Do you encounter any fear that someone will think you are ripping them off should they know your cost-price ratio? If so, look to see what kind of adjustment you want to make in your pricing to bring it back down into the realm of basic fairness rather than get what you can while the getting's good. I dare you to do this. I dare you. It will require complete change in your thinking. You'll have to be just as concerned with your customers or clients as you are with yourself. Yes, you can begin to build this new society right now, right here, today. The choice is yours. You can continue to support the old system, the present paradigm, or you can blaze the trail and show your world a new way. You can be that new way in everything, not just in business, not just in your personal relationships, not just in politics or economics or religion or this aspect or that of the overall life experience, but in everything. Be the new way. Be the higher way. Be the grandest way. Then you can truly say, I am the way and the life. Follow me. If the whole world followed you, would you be pleased with where you took it? Let that be your question for the day.
I hear your challenge. I hear it. Please, tell me more now about life on this planet on a grander scale. Tell me how nation can get along with nation so there'll be war no more.
There will always be disagreements between nations, for disagreement is merely a sign, and a healthy one, of individuality. Violent resolution of disagreements, however, is a sign of extraordinary immaturity. There is no reason in the world why violent resolution cannot be avoided, given the willingness of nations to avoid it. One would think that the massive toll in death and destroyed lives would be enough to produce such willingness, but among primitive cultures such as yours, this is not so. As long as you think you can win an argument, you will have it. As long as you think you can win a war, you will fight it.
What is the answer to all of this?
I don't have an answer. I only have...
I know. An observation.
Yes. I observe now what I observed before. A short-term answer could be to establish what some have called a one-world government, with a world court to settle disputes, one whose verdicts may not be ignored, as happens with the present world court, and a world peacekeeping force to guarantee that no one nation, no matter how powerful or how influential, can ever again aggress upon another. Yet understand that there may still be violence upon the earth. The peacekeeping force may have to use violence to get someone to stop doing so. As I noted in Book 1, failure to stop a despot empowers a despot. Sometimes the only way to avoid a war is to have a war. Sometimes you have to do what you don't want to do in order to ensure that you won't have to keep on doing it. This apparent contradiction is part of the divine dichotomy, which says that sometimes the only way to ultimately be a thing, in this case peaceful, may be at first to not be it. In other words, often the only way to know yourself as that which you are is to experience yourself as that which you are not. It is an observable truth that power in your world can no longer rest disproportionately with any individual nation, but must rest in the hands of the total group of nations existing on this planet. Only in this way can the world finally be at peace, resting in the secure knowledge that no one despot, no matter how big or powerful his individual nation, can or will ever again infringe upon the territories of another nation, nor threaten her freedoms. No longer need the smallest nations depend upon the goodwill of the largest nation, often having to bargain away their own resources and offer their prime lands for foreign military bases in order to earn it. Under this new system, the security of the smallest nations will be guaranteed not by whose back they scratch, but by who is backing them. All 160 nations would rise up should one nation be invaded. All 160 nations would say no should one nation be violated or threatened in any way. Similarly, nations would no longer be threatened economically, blackmailed into certain courses of action by their bigger trading partners, required to meet certain guidelines in order to receive foreign aid, or mandated to perform in certain ways in order to qualify for simple humanitarian assistance. Yet there are those among you who would argue that such a system of global governance would erode the independence and the greatness of individual nations. The truth is, it would increase it. And that is precisely what the largest nations, whose independence is assured by power, not by law or justice, are afraid of. For then no longer would only the largest nation always get its way automatically, but the considerations of all nations would have to be heard equally. And no longer would the largest nations be able to control and hoard the mass of the world's resources, but would be required to share them more equally, render them accessible more readily, provide their benefits more uniformly to all the world's people. A worldwide government would level the playing field, and this idea, while driving to the core of the debate regarding basic human dignity, is anathema to the world's haves, who want the have-nots to go seek their own fortunes, ignoring, of course, the fact that the haves control all that others would seek.
Yet it feels as though we're talking about redistribution of wealth here. How can we maintain the incentive of those who do want more and are willing to work for it if they know they must share with those who do not care to work that hard?
First, it's not merely a question of those who want to work hard and those who don't. That is a simplistic way to cast the argument, usually constructed in that way by the haves.
It's more often a question of opportunity than willingness. So the real job, and the first job in restructuring the social order, is to make sure each person and each nation has equal opportunity. That can never happen so long as those who currently possess and control the mass of the world's wealth and resources hold tightly to that control.
Yes, I mentioned Mexico. And without wanting to get into nation bashing, I think this country provides an excellent example of that. A handful of rich and powerful families control the wealth and resources of that entire nation, and have for 40 years. Elections in this so-called Western democracy are a farce, because the same families have controlled the same political party for decades, assuring virtually no serious opposition. Result, the rich get richer and the poor get poorer. If wages should jump from $1.75 to a whopping $3.15 an hour, the rich point out how much they've done for the poor in providing jobs and opportunity for economic advancement. Yet the only ones making quantum advances are the rich, the industrialists and business owners who sell their commodities on the national and world market at huge profits, given the low cost of their labor. America's rich know this is true, which is why many of America's rich and powerful are rebuilding their plants and factories in Mexico and other foreign countries where slave labor wages are considered a grand opportunity for the peasants. Meanwhile, these workers toil in unhealthy conditions, but the local government, controlled by the same few reaping the profits from these ventures, imposes few regulations. Health and safety standards and environmental protections are virtually non-existent in the workplace. The people are not being cared for, nor is the earth on which they are being asked to live in their paper shacks next to streams in which they do their laundry and into which they sometimes defecate. For indoor plumbing is often also not one of their dignities. What is created by such crass disregard for the masses is a population which cannot afford the very products it is manufacturing. But the rich factory owners don't care. They can ship their goods to other nations where there are people who can. Yet I believe that sooner or later, this spiral will turn in upon itself with devastating consequences, not just in Mexico, but wherever humans are exploited.
Revolutions and civil war are inevitable, as are wars between nations, so long as the haves continue seeking to exploit the have-nots under the guise of providing opportunity.
Holding on to the wealth and the resources has become so institutionalized that it almost now appears acceptable, even to some fair-minded people who see it as simply open-market economics.
Yet only the power held by the world's wealthy individuals and nations makes that illusion of fairness possible. The truth is, it is not fair to the largest percentage of the world's people and nations who are held down from even attempting to achieve what the powerful have achieved. The system of governance described here would drastically shift the balance of power away from the resource-rich to the resource-poor, forcing the resources themselves to be fairly shared.
That is what the powerful fear.
Yes. So the short-term solution to the world's foment may be a new social structure, a new worldwide government. There have been those leaders among you who have been insightful enough and brave enough to propose the beginnings of such a new world order. George Bush, whom history will judge to be a man of far greater wisdom, vision, compassion, and courage than contemporary society was willing or able to acknowledge, was such a leader. So was Soviet President Mikhail Gorbachev, the first communist head of state ever to win the Nobel Peace Prize, and a man who proposed enormous political changes, virtually ending what you've called the Cold War. And so was President Carter, who brought Mr. Begin and Mr. Sadat to come to agreements no one else ever had dreamt of, and who, long after his presidency, pulled the world back from violent confrontation time and time again through the simple assertion of a simple truth. No one's point of view is less worthy of being heard than another's. No one human being has less dignity than another. It is interesting that these courageous leaders, each of whom brought the world from the brink of war in their own time, and each of whom espoused and proposed massive movements away from the prevailing political structure, each served only one term. Removed from office as they were by the very people they were seeking to elevate. Incredibly popular worldwide, they were soundly rejected at home. It is said that a man is without honor in his own home. In the case of these men, it is because their vision was miles ahead of their people, who could see only limited parochial concerns and imagine nothing but loss proceeding from these larger visions. So, too, has every leader who has dared to step out and call for the end of oppression by the powerful been discouraged and defiled. Thus it will always be until a long-term solution, which is not a political one, is put into place. That long-term solution, and the only real one, is a new awareness and a new consciousness. An awareness of oneness and a consciousness of love. The incentive to succeed, to make the most of one's life, should not be economic or materialistic reward. It is misplaced there. This misplaced priority is what has created all of the problems that we have discussed here. When the incentive for greatness is not economic, when economic security and basic materialistic needs are guaranteed to all, then incentive will not disappear, but be of a different sort, increasing in strength and determination, producing true greatness, not the kind of transparent, transient greatness which present incentives produce.
But why isn't living a better life, creating a better life for our children, a good incentive?
Living a better life is a proper incentive. Creating a better life for your children is a good incentive. But the question is, what makes for a better life? How do you define better? How do you define life? If you define better as bigger, better, more money, power, sex, and stuff, houses, cars, clothes, CD collections, whatever. And if you define life as the period elapsing between birth and death in this your present existence, then you're doing nothing to get out of the trap that has created your planet's predicament. Yet if you define better as a larger experience and a greater expression of your grandest state of being, and life is an eternal, ongoing, never-ending process of being, you may yet find your way. A better life is not created by the accumulation of things. Most of you know this. All of you say you understand it. It's your lives and the decisions you make which drive your lives have as much to do with things as anything else, and usually more. You strive for things. You work for things. When you get some of the things you want, you never let them go. The incentive of most of humankind is to achieve, acquire, obtain things. Those who do not care about things, let them go easily. Because your present incentive for greatness has to do with accumulation of all the world has to offer. All of the world is in various stages of struggle. Enormous portions of the population are still struggling for simple physical survival. Each day is filled with anxious moments, desperate measures. The mind is concerned with basic vital questions. Will there be enough food? Is shelter available? Will we be warm? Enormous numbers of people are still concerned with these matters daily. Thousands die each month for lack of food alone. Smaller numbers of people are able to reasonably rely on the basics of survival appearing in their lives, but struggle to provide something more, a modicum of security, a modest but decent home, a better tomorrow. They work hard. They fret about how and whether they'll ever get ahead. The mind is concerned with urgent, worrisome questions. By far the smallest number of people have all they could ever ask for. Indeed, everything the other two groups are asking for. But interestingly, many in this last group are still asking for more. Their minds are concerned with holding on to all that they have acquired and increasing their holdings. Now, in addition to these three groups, there's a fourth. It is the smallest group of all. In fact, it is tiny. This group has detached itself from the need for material things. It is concerned with spiritual truth, spiritual reality, and spiritual experience. The people in this group see life as a spiritual encounter, a journey of the soul. They respond to all human events within that context. They hold all human experience within that paradigm. Their struggle has to do with the search for God, the fulfillment of self, expression of truth. As they evolve, the struggle becomes not a struggle at all, but a process. It is a process of self-definition, not self-discovery. Of growth, not learning. Of being, not doing. The reason for seeking, striving, searching, stretching, and succeeding becomes completely different. The reason for doing anything is changed. And with it, the doer is likewise changed. The reason becomes the process, and the doer becomes a beer. Whereas before, the reason for reaching, for striving, for working hard all of one's life was to provide worldly things. Now the reason is to experience heavenly things. Whereas before, the concerns were largely the concerns of the body. Now the concerns are largely the concerns of the soul. Everything has moved. Everything has shifted. The purpose of life has changed, and so has life itself. The incentive for greatness has shifted. And with it, the need for coveting, acquiring, protecting, and increasing worldly possessions has disappeared. Greatness will no longer be measured by how much one has accumulated. The world's resources will rightly be seen as belonging to all the world's people. In a world blessed with sufficient abundance to meet the basic needs of all, the basic needs of all will be met. Everyone will want it that way. There will no longer be a need to subject anyone to an involuntary tax. You will all volunteer to send 10% of your harvest and your abundance to programs supporting those whose harvest is less. It will no longer be possible for thousands to stand by watching thousands of others starve, not for lack of food, but for lack of sufficient human will to create a simple political mechanism by which people can get the food. Such moral obscenities, now commonplace among your primitive society, will be erased forever the day you change your incentive for greatness and your definition of it. Your new incentive to become what I created you to be, the physical outpicturing of deity itself. When you choose to be who you really are, God made manifest. You will never again act in an ungodly manner. No longer will you have to display bumper stickers which read, God save me from your followers.
Let me see if I'm tracking this. What seems to be emerging here is a world view of equality and equanimity, where all nations submit to one world government and all people share in the world's riches.
Remember, when you talk about equality, that we're meaning equal opportunity, not equality in fact. Actual equality will never be achieved, and be grateful that's so.
Why?
Because equality is sameness. And the last thing the world needs is sameness. No, I'm not arguing here for a world of automatons, each receiving identical allotments from a Big Brother central government. I am speaking of a world in which two things are guaranteed: the meeting of basic needs and the opportunity to go higher. With all your world's resources, with all your abundance, you have not yet managed those two simple things. Instead, you have trapped millions on the lowest end of the socioeconomic scale and devised a worldview that systematically keeps them there. You are allowing thousands to die each year for lack of simple basics. For all the world's magnificence, you have not found a way to be magnificent enough to stop people from starving to death, much less stop killing each other. You actually let children starve to death right in front of you. You actually kill people because they disagree with you. You are primitive.
And we think we're so advanced.
The first mark of a primitive society is that it thinks itself advanced. The first mark of a primitive consciousness is that it thinks itself enlightened.
So let's summarize it. The way we get to the first step on the ladder, where these two fundamental guarantees are accorded everyone,
is through two shifts, two changes, one in your political paradigm, one in your spiritual. The movement to a unified world government would include a greatly empowered world court to resolve international disputes and a peacekeeping force to give power to the laws by which you choose to govern yourself. The world government would include a Congress of Nations, two representatives from every nation on earth, and a people's assembly, with representation in direct proportion to a nation's population.
Exactly the way the U.S. government is set up, with two houses, one providing proportional representation and one providing equal voice to all of the states.
Yes, your U.S. Constitution was God-inspired. The same balance of power should be built into the new world constitution. There would be, likewise, an executive branch, legislative branch, and a judicial branch. Each nation would keep its internal peacekeeping police, but all national armies would be disbanded, exactly as each of your individual states disbanded their armies and navies in favor of a federal peacekeeping force serving the entire group of states you now call a nation. Nations would reserve the right to form and call up their own militia on a moment's notice, just as your states each have the constitutional right to keep and activate a state militia. And just as your states do now, each of the 160 nation states in the Union of Nations would have the right to secede from the Union based upon a vote of the people, though why it would want to do so is beyond me, given that its people would be more secure and more abundant than ever before.
And once more, for those of us who are slow, such a unified world federation would produce
an end to wars between nations and the settling of disputes by killing. An end to abject poverty, death by starvation, and mass exploitation of people and resources by those of power. An end to the systematic environmental destruction of the earth. An escape from the endless struggle for bigger, better, more. An opportunity, truly equal, for all people to rise to the highest expression of self. An end to all limitations and discriminations holding people back, whether in housing, in the workplace, or in the political system, or in personal sexual relationships.
Would your new world order require a redistribution of wealth?
It would require nothing. It would produce, voluntarily and quite automatically, a redistribution of resources. all people would be offered a proper education, for instance. All people would be offered open opportunity to use that education in the workplace, to follow careers which bring them joy. All people would be guaranteed access to health care whenever and however needed. All people would be guaranteed they won't starve to death or have to live without sufficient clothing or adequate shelter. All people would be granted the basic dignities of life so that survival would never again be the issue, so that simple comforts and basic dignities were provided all human beings.
Even if they did nothing to earn it?
Your thought that these things need to be earned is the basis for your thought that you have to earn your way to heaven. Yet you cannot earn your way into God's good graces, and you do not have to, because you are already there. This is something you cannot accept, because it is something you cannot give. When you learn to give unconditionally, which is to say, love unconditionally, then will you learn to receive unconditionally. This life was created as a vehicle through which you might be allowed to experience that. Try to wrap yourself around this idea. People have a right to basic survival, even if they do nothing, even if they contribute nothing. Survival with dignity is one of the basic rights of life. I have given you enough resources to be able to guarantee that to everyone. All you have to do is share.
But what would happen to people? I mean, what would stop people from simply wasting their lives, lollygagging around, collecting benefits?
First of all, it's not yours to judge what is a life wasted. Is a life wasted if a person does nothing but lie around thinking of poetry for 70 years, then comes up with a single sonnet which opens a door of understanding and insight for thousands of people? Is a life wasted if a person lies, cheats, schemes, damages, manipulates, and hurts others all his life, but then remembers something of his true nature as a result of it? Remembers perhaps something he has been spending lifetimes trying to remember, and thus evolves at last to the next level? Is that life wasted? It's not for you to judge the journey of another soul. It's for you to decide who you are, not who another has been or has failed to be. So you ask what would stop people from simply wasting their lives, lollygagging around collecting benefits, and the answer is nothing.
But do you really think this would work? You don't think those who are contributing wouldn't begin to resent those who are not?
Yes, they would, if they're not enlightened. Yet enlightened ones would look upon the non-contributors with great compassion, not resentment.
Compassion?
Yes. Because the contributors would realize that non-contributors are missing the greatest opportunity and the grandest glory. The opportunity to create and the glory of experiencing the highest idea of who they really are. And the contributors would know that this was punishment enough for their laziness, if indeed punishment were required, which it's not.
But wouldn't those who are really contributing be angry at having the fruits of their labor taken from them and given to the lazy ones?
You're not listening. All would be given minimal survival portions. Those who have more would be given an opportunity to contribute 10% of their earnings in order to make this possible. As to how income would be decided, the open marketplace would determine the value of one's contribution, just as it does today in your country.
But then we would still have the rich and the poor, just as we do today. That's not equality.
But it is equal opportunity. For everyone would have the opportunity to live a basic existence without worries of survival. And everyone would be given an equal opportunity to acquire knowledge, develop skills, and use his or her natural talents in the joy place.
The joy place?
Yeah, that's what the workplace will then be called.
But wouldn't there still be envy?
Envy, yes. Jealousy, no. Envy is a natural emotion urging you to strive to be more. It is the 2-year-old child yearning and urging herself to reach that doorknob which your big brother can reach. There's nothing wrong with that. There's nothing wrong with envy. It is a motivator. It is pure desire. It gives birth to greatness. Jealousy, on the other hand, is a fear-driven emotion, making one willing for the other to have less. It is an emotion often based in bitterness. It proceeds from anger and leads to anger, and it kills. Jealousy can kill. Anyone who's been in a jealous triangle knows that. Jealousy kills. Envy gives birth. Those who are envious will be given every opportunity to succeed in their own way. No one will be held back economically, politically, socially. Not by reason of race, gender, or sexual orientation. Not by reason of birth, class, status, or age. Nor for any reason at all. Discrimination for any reason will simply no longer be tolerated. And yes, there may still be the rich and the poor, but there will no longer be the starving and the destitute. You see, the incentive won't be taken out of life, merely the desperation.
But what will guarantee that we'll have enough contributors to carry the non-contributors?
The greatness of the human spirit.
Oh?
Contrary to your apparent dire belief, the average person will not be satisfied with subsistence levels and nothing more. In addition, the whole incentive for greatness will change when the second paradigm shift, the spiritual shift, takes place.
What would cause such a shift? It hasn't occurred yet in the 2,000-year history.
Try 2-billion-year history.
Of the planet, so why should it occur now?
Because with the shift away from material survival, with the elimination of the need to succeed mightily in order to acquire a modicum of security, there will be no other reason to achieve, to stand out, to become magnificent, save the experience of magnificence itself.
And that will be sufficient motivation?
The human spirit rises. It does not fall in the face of true opportunity. The soul seeks a higher experience of itself, not a lower. Anyone who has experienced true magnificence, if only for a moment, knows this.
Well, how about power, then? In this special reordering, there would still be those with inordinate wealth and power.
Financial earnings would be limited.
Oh, boy. Here we go again. You want to explain how that would work before I explain why it won't?
Yes. Just as there would be lower limits on income, so would there be upper limits. First, nearly everyone will tithe 10% of their income to the world government. This is the voluntary 10% deduction I mentioned before.
Yes, the old equal tax proposal.
In your present society at this time, it would have to take the form of a tax because you are not sufficiently enlightened to see that voluntary deduction for the general good is in your best interest. Yet when the shift in consciousness I have been describing occurs, such an open, caring, freely offered deduction from your harvest will be seen by you as obviously appropriate.
I have to tell you something. Do you mind if I interrupt you here to tell you something?
No, go right ahead.
Thanks. This conversation is seeming very strange to me. I mean, I never thought I'd have a conversation with God in which God would start recommending political courses of action. I mean, really, how do I convince people that God is for the flat tax? Indeed.
Well, I see you keep insisting on seeing it as a tax. But I understand that. Because the concept of simply offering to share 10% of your abundance seems so foreign to you. Nevertheless, why do you find it difficult to believe I would have an idea about this?
Well, because I thought God was non-judgmental, had no opinion, didn't care about such things.
Wait, let me get this straight. In our last conversation, I answered all sorts of questions about what makes relationships work, questions about right livelihood, questions about diet even. How does that differ from this?
I don't know. It just seems different. I mean, do you really have a political point of view? Are you a card-carrying Republican? What a truth to come out of this book. God is a Republican.
You'd rather I be a Democrat? Good God.
Cute, cute. No, I'd rather you be apolitical.
I am apolitical. I have no political point of view whatsoever.
Oh, sort of like Bill Clinton.
Hey, good.
Yeah.
Now you're being cute. I like humor, don't you?
Well, I guess I just didn't expect God to be humorous or political.
Or anything human, eh? Okay. Let me place this into context for you once again. I have no preference in the matter of how you conduct your life. My only desire is that you experience yourself fully as a creative being so that you might know who you really are.
Good, I understand that. So far, so good.
Every question I have answered here and every inquiry to which I responded in Book One has been heard, responded to, within the context of what you, as a creative being, say you are attempting to be and do. For instance, in Book One, you asked me many questions about how you could finally make relationships work. Do you remember?
Yes, of course.
Did you find my answers so problematic? Did you find it difficult to believe that I would have a point of view on this?
I never thought about it. I just listened to the answers.
Yes, you see, I was placing my answers within the context of your questions. That is, given that you desire to be or do so-and-so, what is a way to go about that? And I showed you a way.
Yes, you did.
I'm doing the same thing here.
It's just, I don't know, more difficult to believe that God would say these things than it was to believe that God would say those things.
Are you finding it more difficult to agree with some of the things said here?
Well, yeah.
Because if you are, that's very okay.
It is?
Of course.
It's okay to disagree with God?
Certainly. What do you think I'm going to do, squash you like an insect?
Well, I hadn't gotten that far in my thinking, actually.
Look, the world has been disagreeing with me since this whole thing started. Hardly anyone has been doing it my way since it began.
That's true, I guess.
You can be sure it's true. Have people been following my instructions, left with you through hundreds of teachers over thousands of years? The world would be a much different place. So, you wish to disagree with me now? Go right ahead. Besides, I could be wrong.
What?
I said, besides, I could be wrong. Oh, my goodness. You're not taking this all as gospel, are you?
You mean that I'm not supposed to put any stock in this dialogue?
Oops. Hold it. I think you've missed a big part of all this. Let's go back to square one. You're making this all up.
Oh, wow. Well, that's a relief. You see, for a while there, I thought I was actually getting some real guidance here.
The guidance you are getting is to follow your heart. Listen to your soul. Hear yourself. Even when I present you with an option, an idea, a point of view, you are under no obligation to accept that as your own. If you disagree, then disagree. That is the whole point of this exercise. The idea wasn't for you to substitute your dependency on everything and everyone else with a dependency on this book. The idea was to cause you to think. To think for yourself. And that is who I am right now. I am you thinking. I am you thinking out loud.
You mean this material is not coming from the highest source?
Of course it is. Yet here's the one thing you still cannot believe. You are the highest source. And here's the one thing you still apparently do not grasp. You are creating it all. All of your life. Right here. Right now. You are creating it, not me. You. So are there some answers to these purely political questions that you do not like? Then change them. Do it, now. Before you start hearing them as gospel. Before you start making them real. Before you start calling your last thought about something more important, more valid, more true than your next thought. Remember, it's always your new thought that creates your reality. Always. Now, do you find anything in this political discussion of ours that you want to change?
Well, not really. I'm sort of agreeing with you, as it happens. I just didn't know what to make of all this.
Make of it what you wish. Don't you get it? That's what you're doing with all of life.
Okay. All right. I think I've got it. I would like to continue with this conversation, if only to see where it's going.
Fine, then let's do that.
Well, you were about to say...
I was about to say that in other societies, enlightened societies, the putting aside of a set amount of what one receives, what you call income, to be used for the general good of the society itself, is a rather common practice. Under the new system we have been exploring for your society, everyone would earn as much each year as they could, and they would retain what they earn up to a certain limit.
What limit?
An arbitrary limit agreed to by everyone.
And anything above that limit?
Would be contributed to the World Charitable Trust in the name of the contributor, so all the world would know its benefactors. Benefactors would have the option of direct control over the disbursement of 60% of their contribution, providing them the satisfaction of putting most of their money exactly where they want it. The other 40% would be allocated to programs legislated by the World Federation and administered by it.
If people knew, though, that after a certain income limit, everything would be taken from them, what would be their incentive to keep working? What would cause them not to stop in midstream once they reach their income limit?
Some would. So what? Let them stop. Mandatory work above the income limit with contributions to the World Charitable Trust would not be required. The money saved from the elimination of mass production of weapons of war would be sufficient to supply everyone's basic need. The 10% tithe of all that is earned worldwide on top of those savings would elevate all of society, not just the chosen few, to a new level of dignity and abundance. And the contribution of earnings above the agreed-upon limit would produce such widespread opportunity and satisfaction for everyone that jealousy and social angers would virtually disintegrate. So some would stop working, especially those who saw their life activity as real work. Yet those who saw their activity as absolute joy would never stop.
Yes, well, not everyone can have a job like that.
Untrue. Everyone can. Joy at the workplace has nothing to do with function and everything to do with purpose. The mother who wakes up at 4 o'clock in the morning to change her baby's diapers understands this perfectly. She hums and coos to the baby, and for all the world, it doesn't look like what she is doing is any work at all. Yet it is her attitude about what she is doing. It is her intention with regard to it. It is her purpose in undertaking this activity, which make the activity a true joy. I've used this example of motherhood before, because the love of a mother for her child is as close as you may be able to come to understanding some of the concepts of which I'm speaking.
Still, what would be the purpose? I mean, I don't get the purpose of eliminating limitless earning potential. Wouldn't that rob the human experience of one of its greatest opportunities, one of its most glorious adventures?
You'd still have the opportunity and the adventure of earning a ridiculous amount of money. The upper limit on retainable income would be very high, more than the average person, the average 10 people would ever need. And the amount of income you could earn would not be limited, simply the amount you would choose to retain for personal use. The remainder, everything, say, over $25 million a year, I use a strictly arbitrary figure to make a point, would be spent for programs and services benefiting all humankind. As to the reason, the why of it, the upper retainable income limit would be a reflection of a consciousness shift in the planet, an awareness that the highest purpose of life is not the accumulation of the greatest wealth, but the doing of the greatest good. And a corollary awareness that indeed the concentration of wealth, not the sharing of it, is the largest single factor in the creation of the world's most persistent and striking social and political dilemmas.
But the opportunity to amass wealth, unlimited wealth, is the cornerstone of the capitalistic system, a system of free enterprise and open competition that has produced the greatest society the world has ever known.
The problem is, you really believe that.
No, I don't. I mouthed it there on behalf of all those who do believe it.
Those who do believe it are terribly deluded and see nothing of the current reality on your planet. In the United States, the top 1.5% hold more wealth than the bottom 90%. The net worth of the richest 834,000 people is nearly $1 trillion greater than the poorest 84 million combined.
So, they've worked for it.
You Americans tend to see class status as a function of individual effort. Some have made good, so you assume that anybody can. That view is simplistic and naive. It assumes that everyone has equal opportunity, when in fact, in America, just as in Mexico, the rich and powerful strive and contrive to hold on to their money and their power and to increase it.
So, what's wrong with that?
They do so by systematically eliminating competition, by institutionally minimizing true opportunity, and by collectively controlling the flow and the growth of wealth. This they accomplish through all manner of devices, from unfair labor practices which exploit the masses of the world's poor, to good old boy network competitive practices which minimize and all but destroy a newcomer's chances of entering the inner circle of the successful. Then they seek to control public policy and governmental programs around the world to further ensure that the masses of people remain regulated, controlled, and subservient.
I don't believe that the rich do this. Not the largest number of them. I mean, there may be a handful of conspirators, I suppose, but...
In most cases, it isn't rich individuals who do it. It's the social systems and institutions they represent. Those systems and institutions were created by the rich and powerful, and it is the rich and powerful who continue to support them. By standing behind such social systems and institutions, individuals can wash their hands of any personal responsibility for the conditions which oppress the masses while favoring the rich and powerful. For example, let's go back to health care in America. Millions of America's poor have no access to preventative medical care. One cannot point to any individual doctor and say, this is your doing, it's your fault, that in the richest nation on earth, millions cannot get in to see a doctor unless they're in dire straits in an emergency room. No individual doctor is to blame for that, yet all doctors benefit. The entire medical profession and every allied industry enjoys unprecedented profits from a delivery system which has institutionalized discrimination against the working poor and the unemployed. And that's just one example of how the system keeps the rich rich and the poor poor. The point is that it is the rich and powerful who support such social structures and staunchly resist any real effort to change them. They stand against any political or economic approach which seeks to provide true opportunity and genuine dignity to all people. Most of the rich and powerful, taken individually, are certainly nice enough people, with as much compassion and sympathy as anyone. But mention a concept as threatening to them as yearly income limits, even ridiculously high limits such as $25 million annually, and they start whining about usurpation of individual rights, erosion of the American way, and lost incentives. Yet what about the right of all people to live in minimally decent surroundings, with enough food to keep from starving, enough clothing to stay warm? What about the right of people everywhere to have adequate health care? The right not to have to suffer or die from relatively minor medical complications, which those with money overcome with a snap of a finger. The resources of your planet, including the fruits of the labors of the masses of the indescribably poor who are continually and systematically exploited, belong to all the world's people, not just those who are rich and powerful enough to do the exploiting.
And here is how the exploitation works. Your rich industrialists go into a country or an area where there's no work at all, where the people are destitute, where there is abject poverty. The rich set up a factory there, offering those poor people jobs, sometimes 10, 12, and 14-hour day jobs at substandard, if not to say subhuman wages. Not enough, mind you, to allow those workers to escape their rat-infested villages, but just enough to let them live that way as opposed to having no food or shelter at all. And when they are called on it, these capitalists say, hey, they've got it better than before, don't they? We've improved their lot. The people are taking the jobs, aren't they? Why, we've brought them opportunity. And we're taking all the risk. And how much risk is there in paying people 75 cents an hour to manufacture sneakers which are going to sell for $125 a pair? Is this risk-taking or exploitation, pure and simple? Such a system of rank obscenity could exist only in a world motivated by greed. A profit margin, not human dignity, is the first consideration. Those who say that relative to the standards in their society, those peasants are doing wonderfully, are hypocrites of the first order. They would throw a drowning man a rope, but refuse to pull him to shore. Then they would brag that a rope is better than a rock. Rather than raising the people to true dignity, these haves give the world's have-nots just enough to make them dependent, but not enough to ever make them truly powerful. For people of true economic power have the ability to then impact and not merely be subject to the system. And that's the last thing the creators of the system want. So the conspiracy continues. And for most of the rich and powerful, it's not a conspiracy of action, but a conspiracy of silence. So go now, go your way, and by all means say nothing about the obscenity of a socio-economic system which rewards a corporate executive with a $70 million bonus for increasing sales of a soft drink. Now, 70 million people can't afford the luxury of drinking this stuff, much less eating enough to stay healthy. Don't see the obscenity of it. Call this the world's free market economy, and tell everyone how proud you are of it. Yet it is written, if thou wilt be perfect, go and sell what thou hast, and give to the poor, and thou shalt have treasure in heaven. When the young man heard this, he went away sorrowful, for he had great possessions.
I've rarely seen you so indignant. God doesn't become indignant. This proves that you are not God.
God is everything, and God becomes everything. There is nothing which God is not. And all that God is experiencing of itself, God is experiencing in, as, and through you. It is your indignation which you are feeling.
You're right, you know. Because I agree with everything you said.
Know that every thought I am sending you, you are receiving through the filter of your own experience, of your own truth, of your own understandings, and of your own decisions, choices, and declarations about who you are and who you choose to be. There's no other way you can receive it. There's no other way you should.
Well, here we go again. Are you saying that none of these ideas and feelings are yours? That this whole program could be wrong? Are you telling me that this entire experience of my conversation with you could be nothing more than a compilation of my thoughts and feelings on a thing?
Consider the possibility that I am giving you your thoughts and feelings on a thing. Where do you suppose these are coming from? That I am co-creating with you your experiences. That I am part of your decisions, choices, and declarations. Consider the possibility that I have chosen you, along with many others, to be my messenger long before this conversation came to be.
That's hard for me to believe.
Yet I will speak to this world, and I will do it, among other ways, through my teachers and my messengers. And in this book, I will tell your world that its economic, political, social, and religious systems are primitive. I observe that you have the collective arrogance to think they are the best. I see the largest number of you resisting any change or improvement which takes anything away from you. Never mind who it might help.